welcome to Pyramid Podcast, where three lads discuss all things English football pyramid. On today's episode, is the Champions League group stage going to be boring until game week 7 or 8? Was the injury time win versus Coventry a big moment for Big Ange? This weekend sees Man City versus Arsenal. We'll preview plus do a combined 11. In EFL, Wayne Rooney's Plymouth play the league leaders for the second game in a row. Mike Williamson swaps Milton Keynes for Carlisle, and we'll finish with Lauro, who talk us through Yeovil's 0-0 draw versus Altrincham and look ahead to their away fixture this weekend at Oldham. I'm your host, Alex Murphy, and once again, I'm joined by Tom Gallagher and Tom Lawrence. Boys, let's start with the Champs League. And Tomo, I'm sure you've been covering a lot of the games this week with work. Do you think it's going to be a bit of a slow burner until the final weeks of this new big group league format?
Yeah, probably. I mean, it's obviously way too early to judge the format, given that we've not even played all of the first games. We've got tonight's games to come. There are a couple of things I kind of want to bring up, I guess, that I have a couple of reservations about the format. And look, when you play 8 games in a league format, it basically means that every single game in the early stages of that format does feel a little bit less significant. So if you take AC Milan and Liverpool, for example, it's a former Champions League final, a massive European tie, and Liverpool won the game. But does it feel like, and at the San Siro as well, and in the old format, you think, oh, AC Milan have got a lot to do to qualify now, because you expect Liverpool to beat them in the return leg at Anfield. Do you know what I mean? And it feels sort of that result would be significant. Whereas now, AC Milan have still got 7 games to qualify, to get into the top 24, to qualify for the next round. So that's sort of one negative, a slight negative I have. Another negative, I guess, is that basically, because there's more teams in the whole of the Champions League, it does feel like there's a couple of, like, lower down in the sort of food chain, there's a lot more like Europa League level games. Like if you take Celtic and versus Slovan Bratislava, just like it feels like that level is not really the Champions League level. But then maybe I'm just looking at that a little bit too introspectively, because there were probably fixtures like that in last season's competition. And just one point, another point I want to make before you come in as well, is the reason why we've done this Swiss style, or UEFA have changed the Champions League to this Swiss style format, is so that we can have more big games among the big teams. So you take this week, for example, Inter Milan, Man City, Atalanta, Arsenal, AC Milan, Liverpool. You've got massive games coming up. I think Real Madrid play PSG. Real Madrid play also Liverpool. The thing is, the reason why those big games are so special in the latter stages of the Champions League are because they mean something, and because there's a lot on the line, either qualifying for the semi-final of the Champions League or the final of the Champions League or winning the whole thing. Whereas they're playing these games in this format, and it certainly feels like, at this stage anyway, for the first few weeks of this format, these games don't really mean a lot. So AC Milan and Liverpool play each other doesn't really mean a lot. The consequences aren't there. The jeopardy's not there. So therefore, the interest in that game isn't as high as it would be. That's just a couple of things I thought. But like I said in at the start of the conversation, it is far too early to judge.
And am I right in saying that there's like the top 8 qualify automatically to go through to the last 16, and then the middle 16 teams will then play each other in a one-game playoff to be the other sides to go through, and the bottom 8 teams, rather than drop into Europa, just go out? But if that is right, then in my mind, it's like you got to do pretty well with the amount of teams that are in there, and some of the rubbish that will be in there, some of the kind of lower ranking sides from smaller nations, to finishing that bottom 8. Like, you, even if AC Milan's example lost at home to Liverpool, I don't know what the par points is going to be, but they just need to finish inside the top 24 to then have a two-legged tie or one-legged tie to go through to the last 16 anyway. So it just doesn't feel like there's too much consequence in losing a Champions League game.
Yeah, but you could also spin it on its head. And say if it was last season's format, you could, if you finished third in your group, you drop down to the Europa League. And for the likes of Man United and Newcastle, who finished fourth in their group last year, didn't drop down. That's the sort of the jeopardy, because Man United and Newcastle could have potentially won the Europa League last year. Well, definitely not Man United, but you are right. It does feel like this league phase is a little bit pointless. But a big talking point at the minute is how many of the games are playing, how many games that players are playing. And obviously the players have come out this week enforcing Jules Koundé, Rodri, Alisson, Danny Carvajal. They're all talking about potentially going on strike. And the big thing that, like, this sort of Champions League format, I guess, the big thick carrot of qualifying for the top eight is that you play two less games. So that's the sort of the modern football, the level we're talking about now is the big thing you want is to play less games. So if you qualify in the top eight of this big Champions League phase, then you'll play two less games. So it's a sad indictment of modern football, I think.
Two less games than the other teams below you, but two more than last year, where you were in a six-game group and go through to the last 16. So, right, well, jury's out on that. I'm sure it's going to get a lot more exciting where those sort of, you know, that sort of eighth and ninth spot, who's going through automatically, who's going to the playoffs, who's getting into the playoffs, who's getting relegated, starts to take shape. I'm sure it will get a little bit more exciting. But yeah, jury's definitely out for that.
Can I just quickly make a quick one shout as well? It's actually, if you remember, you cast your mind, maybe we're a bit too young really, but in the early 2000s, the Champions League, they tried this two group stage format where they had, basically they did a group of four before Christmas and a group of four after Christmas, and then played a quarterfinal, semi-final, final. And I think that format only lasted 2 years because it was utter shite. And I wonder if this fails spectacularly, whether we'll just go back to the old format pretty quickly.
Yeah, maybe. Although it's more games and it's about money now, isn't it? And revenue and more match days. So that's always going to win over the quality of the competition, I think, personally.
Maybe.
Well, one player who certainly had a good start, Laurie, was Harry Kane. Four goals for him in the first group game, including a hat-trick of penalties as well within it. I think that's the first player to score a hat-trick of penalties in a Champions League game. I think it takes him past Wayne Rooney now for the top English goal scorer in the Champions League as well. Not bad for someone who was all but done in the summer.
Yeah, well, I said this last week. I think it's a sad indictment on the quality of media and punditry that one of the biggest talking points of the summer is Kane finished and will he be at the next big tournament, major tournament for England, just because he only limped to being the Golden Boot winner or joint Golden Boot winner at the Euros this summer. I think he's already got seven goals or something this season, hasn't he? So, but we had this exact conversation last week. Harry Kane's absolutely fine. He'll score another 50 a year for the next 5 years, I think. So a bit of a non-story, that one.
Well, one man who'd certainly like him up front, back at Spurs, is Big Ange. And Laura, in the EFL Cup, or before the game, Big Ange said that he's always won something in his second season. Seems like he's just lost a little bit of his happy, chilled out, we'll have a go, mate, persona. Do you think that was a big win for him against Coventry, or do you not think it's at that stage or anywhere near that stage yet?
It's not. It's definitely not anywhere near that stage in terms of if you're alluding to his job security. But when you say something like that, which I think he probably regrets now, I always win something in my second year, just trying to make a point of his previous successes. You can't then go and get knocked out of the Carabao Cup in the week, the one trophy that you've probably got any chance at all of winning. I think he backtracked a little bit in the week and said, I don't get all the fuss. I won't say it next year if we don't win anything this year. And I thought, oh, you've shat it a little bit there. But to be fair, I mean, if you're Tottenham, you should be looking to try and get fourth and try and win a Carabao Cup, aren't you? That's what a really good season would look like. And I think a lot of that, I was saying this to you off there the other day, I think that Tottenham have actually got a really good base now. I think when you go through their team, they actually look really good. I think their defence is, their back four is unbelievable in terms of modern football with Poro and Udogi and Mickey and Romero at the back there. And I think a lot will hinge on whether they can get the goals at the centre forward and whether Solanke can be that. It's not going to be up to Harry Kane's levels, but if he can be that 30-goal-a-season man, then I think Ange will bear some fruit. Whether it will be this season or not, I don't know. But I think I've said before, I think Tottenham are, for me, under the radar. I think they might get that fourth spot. But whether they win a trophy or not, it probably depends on how seriously Man City take it.
Quickly, on Tottenham, I think they could potentially be one of the biggest beneficiaries from this new Champions League format. And I say that because there are no Champions League clubs coming into the Europa League this season. So essentially, Tottenham will be playing Europa League football, and they'll be one of the favourites to win the competition straight away. And they won't have like an unlucky sort of season where Liverpool and Barcelona drop in, or Liverpool and, do you know what I mean? So not only are they like Lauro says, Carabao Cup, massive opportunity to win a trophy. FA Cup, they need to put everything into that as well. But the Europa League, that's a big, big competition that they can win, sort of to get that monkey off their back. Because when was the last trophy they won? Was it like 2007 Carling Cup?
Was that a Jonathan Woodgate one?
Yeah. So, they've got three big opportunities, because I think we can all agree they're definitely not going to win the Prem. But yeah, it was a big, big result for them last night, just because given the context of everything, losing a North London derby, given the context of those comments, it did feel like if they just go and lose to Coventry, it's like double schnut for Ange, but he's got away with it a little bit.
I just think, and the reason I said about was that a big result for him, is I watched the final part of that, obviously, where they turned it round. And when they went to the studio, they were kind of making it out as if that was like Big Ange, like Brennan Johnson and Jed Spence scoring was like the equivalent of Mark Robbins scoring for United to save Fergie. Just like, I know it was against Coventry, so it's an easy comparison to make when Robbins is manager there, but... And then, like, Jamie Redknapp was saying, I thought the team was really disrespectful from Spurs. But I looked at it. It had Udogi in it. Dragusin, who was signed, who's a top centre-half. Archie Gray was signed for 35, 40 mil. Benton Kerr, Timo Werner, Champs League winner. Solanke signed for big money. Odebert signed. So it kind of just felt like a bit of a pile-on from the media to me, because I don't think that's that disrespectful at all. Because if you then get an injury to a Son or a Maddison away at Coventry and they miss a couple months, and you're told that you should be rotating the likes of those guys and Kulusevski. So, I just couldn't really get my head round that. And I wondered if I'd missed something, and it was a way bigger game for Big Ange than what on the face of it was just a cup tie away at Coventry.
I think the biggest story from that game as a neutral was the fact that Brandon Thomas Asante scored for Coventry. Now, obviously, he's a West Brom player. So I would imagine that... I would imagine that Carlos Corberan and the sort of hierarchy at the Hawthorns are investigating that and taking a bit of a closer look. I'm sure they're glad that he's got on the score sheet, but just for their Midlands counterparts, I could not believe that when I saw. I thought it was a misprint, but maybe that's allowed in the modern game.
Do you know what? In that same instance, though, Murph, I do think Jamie Redknapp, if Tottenham had put out their first 11 and won 2-0, but say a couple of the lads got injured, Jamie Redknapp would be in the studio and be like, that starting 11 was an absolute disaster. He shouldn't have done that. Do you know what I mean? So you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't as a manager. You just got to make these decisions and live and die by them. And let's be honest, he certainly does that.
Yeah, I just thought it's exactly what a Prem side does. You have the likes of Johnson, Kulusevski, Maddison, Porro, Son on the bench, so that you can bring him on if you're in trouble, and that's what he did, and they won the game. But I think the worst part about the EFL Cup for me is the fact that the EFL sides rotate their tip players. It's almost like they want out of it. It's like they use that as an opportunity to give their squad players games when they've got Premier League opposition. And I think Barnsley made a few changes, Tomo, and obviously, you know, I don't think they've particularly taken that competition too seriously, because ultimately, very unlikely they're going to win it. And people have got league campaigns to concentrate on, which I think EFL managers are judged by. But United absolutely spanked them.
Yeah, but do you know as well, I actually think some EFL managers almost, they use these sort of big EFL games away from home against the top Premier League clubs as almost like a a carrot to dangle in front of their squad players. You have to say, look, yeah, you're not in my starting 11 week in, week out, but you might play at Old Trafford. And let's have it right, a League Two or a League One player who plays at Old Trafford might only play at Old Trafford once in their career. It's a big, huge deal. So, and also, they've just got to be realistic, haven't they? Look, their priorities are the league. It's always going to be the league. I don't know. I'm not old enough to sort of remember whether League One or Championship clubs used to do this in the sort of the 90s in the FA Cup and the Carabao Cup. But it does feel like as the games pile up and as the years go on, it feels like that like they do use the second teams. But I did listen to a Jamie Carragher overlap podcast this morning, and he was mentioning when he got his debut and it was in the Carling Cup. And he said that used to be the case all the time. And so I guess it's just always happened. We just like to moan.
Yeah. I think FA Cup still got like a level of prestige about it where like the first team want to play FA Cup games. You don't see as much rotation unless you've got like a, you know, Premier League side go into a League Two or sort of non-league opposition. But like United played down at Yeovil and they still had the likes of, you know, Rooney and Di Maria and Falcao and Herrera and players like that. So I think the FA Cup still got some like prestige amongst all the big sides and league sides with their first team wanting to play. But Carling Cup or Carabao Cup certainly feels like one which is just a rotation until maybe you get to the semis.
Just a quick point on that, actually. So Erik ten Hag made quite a few changes on Tuesday. And I think a criticism of him over the last two seasons has been his injury record. And another criticism has been, actually, he hasn't rotated as much as normal managers would in that scenario. And it feels like Tuesday's game was an acknowledgement of how basically he overplays some of those first team players. Because he made quite a few changes, and hopefully that continues going forward. Because let's have it right, if Man United have another season like last season where they get injury after injury, then we're going to struggle to get in the top eight again.
Okay, on that, Lauro, if from an outsider's perspective, if United had the same league campaign that they did, but they won the FA Cup again or went and won the Europa League, do you think a trophy a season, regardless of style of play and league position, would be Ten Hag just, you know, you're winning trophies, you keep your job?
I don't think that should be the way, no. I think it should be deeper than that. If that happened again, but we can all see a stark improvement in the way that Man United are playing, and it hasn't quite transpired into a league position yet, then fair enough. But if it's the same as it was last season, the season before, and what it looks to be at the start of this season, barring the last two games against Southampton and Barnsley, I think we should, you know, look a little bit further ahead if you're in control of a football club like Man United. And I think I've said before, if we're talking about Ten Hag, I don't think he should be in a job, and I don't think he would be if that FA Cup didn't come at the end of last season. As great as they were in that game, I think it's sort of looking at the short term to harm the long term in that regard. So, no, I don't think so, is the answer.
Well, move on to the Premier League, lads. And this weekend, we see Man City versus Arsenal. And before we move on to that game, Laurie, we spoke on the pod last time out about a test of Arsenal's title credentials to go to the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. We knew they would have to do it without Declan Rice. They knew how to do it without Martin Odegaard. And they won the game. Gabriel scoring the only goal of the game after we all said it would be a thriller with loads of goals. But what a result for Arsenal and what a boost for them.
Yeah, and I think to do it without it being the end-to-end game and actually going, it's all very well setting up for one of those kind of defensive away performances where you soak up kind of the enthusiasm of the home team and then hit them with a sickener. And it's another thing doing it. And Arsenal just have shown that they've just got that little bit of cuteness, I think, to go and implement that against a top side in a rowdy atmosphere. And we said before the game in last week's pod that it would be a massive test of their title credentials. I think that's the title sewn up for them. I genuinely do. I think we'll see a very, very similar performance and result against Man City at the weekend. And I would be really, really surprised to see anything other than that. So we can play this back next week. I guarantee you now Arsenal will win by I think it'll be 1-0. Very, very similar performance. and we'll be lauding Mikel Arteta a little bit more next week because they'll probably move into favourites if and when that happens. So, yes, massive, massive, massive result. And, you know, you kind of half expected them to do something like they did, but to go out and actually execute it, I thought was phenomenal.
Tomo, any counter-argument to the fact that Arsenal are 100% going to win at the Etihad on Sunday?
No, I don't think they're 100% going to win. But look, if we take these two teams and look at their sort of like their summers, if you take Arsenal, they've added defensive depth in Calafiore, and they've also, let's have it right, Julian Timber is basically a new signing, and he has been immense at the start of the season. So they've added Timber and Calafiore, and I know Mikel Merino's injured at the minute, but he had a good Euros with Spain. Looks like a really solid midfield player who will shore up that area of the pitch as well. So they've certainly strengthened in areas, maybe not all of the areas they particularly wanted. If you ask Arsenal fans, they'd probably say they wanted another striker. And then if you look at Man City, their two big signings, if you will, they sold Julian Alvarez and they brought in Savinho. I know they brought back Ilkay Gundogan back to the club, but he's another year older. Not sure. I mean, he will seamlessly slip back in, but I'm not sure how effective he will be at making a difference as he was when he was there 2 years ago. So if you take all to that into consideration, Arsenal have got stronger and arguably Man City have got a little bit weaker. So do I think Arsenal will go and win against Man City at the Etihad on the weekend? Probably not. But I do think they'll win the league.
Funny game, isn't it? We were talking about Arsenal slip up against Spurs and City do the business against Brentford, which they did do in the end. And then City beat Arsenal this weekend and suddenly Arsenal are out of the title race and now they're sewn up as champions. Amazing what a week in footy could do. But Tomo, it's an interesting point you make there about the kind of team depth and the squad depth and, you know, Arsenal adding and City maybe being a tiny little bit weaker. So interested to hear your boys' combined 11 now for Arsenal and Man City, if you could do it. So we'll just do a bit round robin. I'm going to play a 4-2-3-1, unless one of you wants to call out you're playing a different formation, which you can do when we go through that position. Just do a bit of a round robin on position. And if you both go different, I'll have the deciding vote and we'll have the pod combined 11 then. So in goal, Lauro?
Edison.
Tomo?
Yeah, Edison, yeah.
Lauro, back four.
Walker, Saliba, Gabriel and Gardiel.
Tomo?
Completely agree.
No Ruben Dias in anyone's team?
No, I mean, I do think he's an excellent defender, but just because City rotate quite a lot in that area, they'll have Stones, they'll have Akanji, they'll have Ake, doesn't feel like Ruben Dias is like as important or as Gabriel. And the only reason, or one of the big reasons why I picked Saliba and Gabriel is because they come as a pair. And I think quite clearly they are the best centre-back pair in the league.
It's really nice to see that as well, because I think the Prem's been a bit devoid of that old-fashioned kind of centre-back partnership. One of the best qualities you can have as a centre-back is being complementary of your partner. Like we used to see the sort of Ferdinands and Vidic's and the Terrys and Carvalhos. We haven't had it for a long time at a top club, really. And I just think it's really, really, I mean, Gabriel, I don't think it'd be easy to slip in a Dias in front of him. He doesn't get the plaudits just because Saliba's just so elite. But he's really good as well, Gabriel. In both boxes, he's a monster. They're both absolute Trojans. So it's got to be those two.
Fair enough. And just thinking there, no John Stones either. Kudos to Gabriel. Well, I can't have a deciding vote when you've both agreed. So that's our back four.
Quickly on John Stones, because I think he's unbelievable. And again, for England at the Euros, he's unbelievable. But his injury record is one that worries me. And so I wouldn't have him in there just because he's basically, he plays half a season every season. Plays at a high level, but can you rely on him?
No, fair enough. You boys have thoroughly justified it. So happy with that. Two midfielders, Laura.
4-2-3-1. Rodri.
Yeah.
And Rice.
Rodri and Rice, Tomo, or
no, I would go. Well, I'm assuming Laura's going to have Kevin De Bruyne in that 10.
When you assume, you know what happens.
Yeah, you make an ass out of you and me, but
not me, just yourself.
Yeah, but look, let's take it as a three, Murph. I would have Rodri, Odegaard, and De Bruyne.
Okay.
I'm having Rodri, Rice, and Odegaard.
Wow. Okay. So I have got to have then Rodri and Odegaard because they're both in your side. And then I've got to decide between Rice and KDB. Based on the fact that Odegaard is in it, I'll have to have Rice for the balance, but I'm not happy at leaving KDB out. I will put on record I'd have Rodri, Rice, KDB. But for our team, it will be Rodri, Rice, Odegaard.
And I think then Kevin De Bruyne has fallen off a cliff. I think he's half the man he once was. He looks weak. I don't think that he's affecting things like he once did. He definitely isn't. And I think as soon as Haaland stops scoring a hat-trick every week, which is the only reason I was telling everyone at the start of the season not to have him in your FBL, because he'd have to score a hat-trick every week to be worth the 15 million, and so far he's scored a hat-trick every week, I think we're going to see a bit of a slump from Man City. And it last season they needed Foden to pick him out of it, not Kevin De Bruyne. So, and I think Odegaard's really instrumental in a team that's going to be the title winners this year. So that's why I've gone for Odegaard over KDB.
No, solid justification. And Tomo, your front three, please.
Saka on the right, self-explanatory. Haaland up top. And who did I go on the left?
You went to Foden.
Yeah, Foden. Yeah, which probably that's the problem with these combined 11s. You always have one or two players playing at a position. Like a little bit like Gareth Southgate's England, really, because as we saw at the Euros, Foden isn't a left winger, but I'd have him there.
Laurie?
Yeah, okay, obviously Saka and Haaland. Foden and Bernardo is a massive quandary because you want Foden in there, but we've spent all summer bemoaning the Foden on the left one. But it kind of works better with City because they play a little bit more fluid than the sort of rigid England style. So, yeah, I'll agree with Phil on the left.
Okay. I'd have gone Bernardo, but again, I can't have a casting vote. And Tomo, you asking who you went for completely takes away the organic nature where we're just doing this off the cuff. Everyone now knows we've rehearsed it offline and my fake shock at your selections. But anyway, so boys, that leaves us with a final team then, which I think you agree is pretty tasty, of Edison in goal, Kyle Walker at right back, Saliba and Gabriel at the heart of defence with Garvidal at left back. Rodri and Rice sat screening in front of a front four of Martin Odegaard, who's feeding the ball out wide to Saka and Foden. And in the middle, Erling Haaland, who scores hat-tricks every game. So, yeah, not a bad side that at all. But yeah, big game. Looking forward to it. Obviously, you boys both think Arsenal are going to win the league. I think if they got any chance to win the league, that will need to be 3 points at the Etihad, and what a big statement that will be from it. And we'll obviously watch out for that. Just before we move on to the EFL, Tom, I just wanted to touch on one result from last week in the Prem, because we were obviously very, very complimentary of Liverpool and the start they've made, but a little bit of a bump back down to earth, losing 1-0 at home to Forest with Hudson-Odoi scoring a great goal. About the 75th minute to win it.
Yeah, but look, those results can happen in the Premier League, where just a club like Forest, basically, they set up really well. They funneled Liverpool like onto the wings, and then they didn't make any mistakes and just defended unbelievably. And then I don't know what minute it was, maybe 60th minute, they bring on the likes of Alanga and Callum Hudson-Odoi. Use their pace on the counter attack, and it worked to perfection. Alanga set up Hudson-Odoi cuts inside, scores an unbelievable goal. Don't really need to
describe it because it's Thursday and I assume everyone's watched it by now. But yeah, then I listened to a few of the podcasts that you listened to on Monday and everyone's like, oh, have Liverpool and have Arne Slot been found out? But then they go to the San Siro on Tuesday or was it a Wednesday and they absolutely dominate, win 3-1. It's like, oh, Slot's the best thing since sliced bread again. So all very fickle a little bit. And yeah, just that those results can happen in the season. I wouldn't sort of worry too much about it as long as it doesn't happen week after week. And they play Bournemouth on Saturday at Anfield. So a similar test probably. And if they go and win that, then it's 4 wins out of 5 and it's all rosy again.
Yeah, I've really, 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 Mo Salah, if you are listening to the pod, which I know you tend to do, please, 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 I need Brace hat-trick minimum for FPL. I've backed you over Haaland since the start and I got 26 points last week and I think Haaland got 28 as captain. So please, Mo, please help me.
I think just quickly as well, like, just have to say, really, like, fair play to Forest. Not a team that come in for an awful lot of positive media, are they? But I think that game and how Tomo just described the way that they won is a little bit kind of Nuno at Wolves-esque, where he had a very successful stint a few years back now, getting them out of the Championship and then consolidating as a really top sort of, or easily deserved Premier League side, and they still are now. And they've had just as good a start to the season as Brighton. Nottingham Forest, and they won't get anywhere near the level of credit that they do. So, you know, I don't know how much it was Liverpool off it, but Nottingham Forest just sticking to the game plan and it worked wonders.
It's funny, isn't it, how like they drew with Wolves, Forest, and drew with Bournemouth and edged past Southampton. So if they'd have lost to Liverpool, it'd be like, oh, it looked a bit of a shaky start for Forest, like only picked up one win, but a win at Anfield and winning as they did. And, you know, Chris Wood has been scoring some goals. You say about the likes of Alanga and Hudson-Odoi, and everyone knows what Morgan Gibbs-White's about. That suddenly looks like a really great start for them. As you say, similar to Brighton, and they've got Brighton this weekend, so be great.
That's the problem with judging things so early on in the season. Like, if you look at the table, you'd think, oh, Newcastle, what a start. Third, Eddie Howe's got them going again. They were bang lucky to get past Tottenham, should have lost the game, and they needed 2 30-odd wonder strikes to beat Wolves at the weekend. So if those two go the other way, suddenly they're down, you know, in the middle half of the bottom half. So it's far too early to start casting aspersions on the likelihood of people keeping their jobs, etc., unless they look really, really bad, like they do at Goodison Park. But yeah, good, really good start for Nottingham Forest. So I think needed to be called out because that's a big win at Anfield, and very rarely would we speak about Nottingham Forest on this podcast, probably for good reason.
Well, we did have a bit of a Teo Wamne phone in last year, didn't we, where we were a fan of his for a few weeks. So,
and I was full of praise for their was it their owner that come out and started saying the PGMO are corrupt because they put in a fan of, I don't know what it was, I can't remember now, but I was really
in is like a ref director, didn't they, and then just basically called the PGMO out for cheating.
Yeah, I thought that was brilliant. Loved that. Need more of it.
So actually Forrest get fair crack of the whip on this pod.
They do.
Right, boys, let's move on to the EFL. And Wayne Rooney's Plymouth, home to Sunderland. Sunderland absolutely flying in the league. And you're probably thinking it's going to be another loss and the pressure mounting on Rooney. But ex-Yeovil player Joe Edwards pops up very late on in the game to win it 3-2 for them. Massive result for Plymouth and for Wazza.
Yeah, unbelievable win. Again, it seems like a bigger win because Sunderland were top with 4 wins out of 4, but we were only 4 games into the season. So how good a side Sunderland are, minus Jack Clark, is yet to be seen. But now you've got to look at Plymouth and think, well, they're quite comfortably the smallest side in that league and probably everyone's prediction to finish 24th. And now they're level with the likes of Bristol City, Norwich and Coventry. And no one's going to be speaking about Mark Robbins or the Bristol City manager losing their job. So I think we've got to say well done to Wayne Rooney. I don't think the XG has been particularly good this season, but why does that matter when you're winning 3-2 at home to top of the league with a last minute winner on a Saturday afternoon? I expect the Pilgrims are pretty happy. So fantastic to see. Nice to see Wayne Rooney with a smile on his face. And hopefully, I think what success for Plymouth? I mean, staying up, really, to be honest with you. And to be 16th at the end of the season, I expect they'd bite your hand off for it.
Yeah, I wonder what actually Rooney's hoping to get out of it. Because if you finish, if you stay up and finish 20th, you've still lost the majority of games in the league. But he's kept them up with probably one of the smaller budgets and certainly one of the smaller stadiums. So, what you know, what's he looking to get out of it, Wayne Rooney? This is what I don't get about Rooney. He's got, and this is fair play to him, he's got all of these millions. He's got the playing career he's had. He could probably walk into a punditry job at any station and be there full time. But he seems to still have this hunger and desire to succeed at football. But I just don't get what he wants out of Plymouth.
Yeah, well, I mean, go on.
I was going to say, without being like playing amateur psychologist, it does feel like he needs daily routine football in his life every single day. When you saw his time between Birmingham and Plymouth, I think he spent most of it on FIFA, getting pissed late at night, playing like FIFA, like Twitch
with
wars
angry
with like, angry gins and stuff. So it does feel like he's the type of character who needs like to be on the grass every day. He needs to be busy just to keep his sort of his life on track, if that's a good way of putting it. But also, Plymouth were probably the sort of, that was the level that he was going to get at this stage of his career, because his managerial career, albeit it started quite well with Derby, I know they got relegated, but massive like trying circumstances, and I think they did okay. Whereas with Birmingham, struggled, with DC United, struggled. So where else was he going to go? Do you know what I mean?
I think there's an argument to say, if you're getting Plymouth, a championship side, and maybe a better or a wiser career move would be a top-end League One side where you could go for promotion. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know, like a Wrexham or something like that. Not that those jobs were necessarily available. But if I was Wayne Rooney, I would be saying, I want in my contract, I cannot be sacked unless we drop into the relegation zone. Because it's really easy within football these days to lose four or five and just get sacked. And if you're a Plymouth and you're probably going to be in the bottom five or six, at some point you probably are going to lose a few on the spin. And he doesn't want his name getting further sort of trounced into the mud off the back of a few unsuccessful stints just because Plymouth have lost a few games, which they're going to do every single season in the Championship because they're one of the smallest clubs. So hopefully he's got some sort of security here that he obviously wasn't given at Birmingham because he only got a couple of months. That as long as he does okay, he won't be hung out to the wolves.
Yeah, I hope so, because I struggle to see what success is going to look like for him. I don't see long term he's suddenly going to start over 5 years getting them up towards a title contender or a promotion contender just due to the size of the club and the budget that they've got. So I'm intrigued to see where it ends. I think I know where it ends, but just intrigued to see where it does end up for him. Just before we move on to a little bit further down the EFL pyramid, Laurie, just want to touch on Leeds. I know, obviously, Yeovil were playing last weekend, but did you catch much of the game against Burnley?
All of it.
Any thoughts?
Yeah, we battered them. Yeah, Leeds battered Burnley at the weekend. I mean, this happens all the time, doesn't it? The sort of armchair fan that will sit back lazily and yawn and go, Leeds are falling apart again. You play like that every week, they'll win the league, I promise you. Leeds will win the league if they play like that every week. It was so dominant that when the ball broke to Cole Osho about 60 yards from our goal, there was not one Leeds defender in sight, because I don't even blame them. I was sat there thinking I wouldn't have stayed in our own half there, because Burnley are getting absolutely nowhere near us here. They had him on one side, who he's probably a Premier League player. Jadon Anthony, who's a really nice gentleman, but rubbish at football on the other side, and there was no real danger. And his goal was very reminiscent to Gus Hamer's goal for Sheffield United the night before at Hull. So they then sort of sat in, and they've got a decent sort of enough low block, haven't they? And we weren't able to break them down. We had a couple of big chances. Willy Nonto should have scored the dozy get. But other than that, we were very good. And I'll be happy if we play like that every week, because we'll win the league.
Starting off this weekend at Cardiff, I believe. So hopefully Leeds back on track for that. Tomo, want to move on to a little bit further down the EFL pyramid, and a bit of news that's broken is that Mike Williamson who is the Milton Keynes manager, has been announced as the Carlisle manager, which is going to need some explaining for me, please, because I didn't realise that that was allowed.
Wasn't he Gateshead manager?
I can tell this is going to be top insight. Shall I take over?
Yeah, I don't know I don't know why you've asked me that question.
That's going to take some explaining.
And I'm just like, well, you could have brought that up before the podcast, so I could do a little bit of research.
Tomo, I thought now, with how you came on Leaps and Bounds, that all of these EFL would be finger on the pulse, but that...
So, MK Dons have had a shocker of a start to the season, and they were pretty much title favourites before it. The Carlisle managerial post is available, and I think that they were interested in Mike Williamson, have looked at how he's done at Milton Keynes and thought he might be up for the sack soon, made an inquiry, and the new ownership group at Milton Keynes have said to Williamson, look, we're going to sack you here, but obviously if you take the Carlisle job, it looks a lot better for you. So that's why I think that move has happened. And obviously Carlisle's kind of in the same neck of the woods as Gateshead, where he was at before, you're quite right, Tombo, and he used to play for Newcastle as well. So although he hasn't got any accent like Williamson, I guess he's based up north. And I think probably Carlisle will suit him. But probably a little bit harsh. I don't think the change of ownership there would have helped him, because I think over his entire tenure, he's done well. They were really struggling last year, Mike Williamson. Then he took him into the playoffs. Then they lost something like 12-0 to Crawley, and everyone was like, what on earth's happened here? And the start of the season's been poor, but that doesn't define him. He'll do well at Carlisle, and interesting to see who next gets the MK Dons job, because that should really be quite an attractive one. They've sort of spent well in the summer, albeit the players haven't hit the heights that they were expected to so far.
We will never know now how I would have answered that question, but I was going to say, before you boys broke out into fits of laughter, I was going to say that he was the Gateshead manager before, so it might be like a personal issue where he's moving back up north. And obviously they did get spun by AFC Wimbledon, their biggest rivals, last weekend, was it? So I was going to say that, but we'll never know now.
We won't.
Hold on. 2 seconds. Okay, fair enough. I actually thought he was from down south, Williamson, so it would be weird to go to Carlisle on a personal note, but he's from Stoke, which is in the middle of nowhere, really, isn't it? So I expect he'd rather be anywhere than there.
Yeah. So he played at Newcastle, managed at Gateshead, and so yeah. I'm assuming that's where he's based.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's just gone to the Lake District now for a personal reason. We're all on a learning journey. Tomo, I saw Mbappe scored in the Champs League.
That's the question we planned.
Yeah, sorry. Right, boys, one result I want to touch on from last weekend as well is the FA Cup happened, and a team in step 4 of non-league, Bishop's Cleeve, beat Torquay 3-0. Now, Torquay are obviously a National League South side. Bishop's Cleeve down in the Southern First League, so the lower echelons of non-league football. Not only did they beat them 3-0 at home. They're going into the hat for the next round of the FA Cup. I don't think National League teams or Football League teams join at this round. They'd have to get through another one, but biggest result in their club's history. Amazing for a side that low down to beat a team like Torquay. And I think Paul Wotton, the Torquay manager, was pretty embarrassed by it, because I don't think it was a case of them resting too many players. So massive result for them, and just wanted to give them a big shout out. Laura, come on to Yeovil then. Last weekend, 0-0 draw at home to Altrincham. Just a little bit on how that game was, and then a little bit of a preview ahead of going to Oldham at the weekend.
I don't think we should spend too much time on this podcast, if we want it to be successful, talking about Yeovil Town 0, Altrincham 0 at Hewish Park. It pretty much was exactly how it would sound. And even the fans of those two respective sides don't want to hear too much more about it.
Laura,
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question then? Because maybe not on that game, but give us 2 reasons or 3 reasons why Yeovil are struggling to score at home, because we've not scored at home in the last 3 games now, have we?
No, I think that is an evaluation of four games. Again, it's difficult early on in the season to make big conclusions. In our last two away games, we've scored seven. So we've got something right going forward. It's just about clicking at the right times. We've definitely had the slightly easier games away from home. We've sort of played Boston that came up, filed that were down there. And at home, we've kind of had those like ex-EFL sides a lot of the time so far, Hartlepool, Rochdale. And to be fair, we lost five strikers in the summer. Rhys Murphy went, Jake Hyde went, Alex Fisher went, Malachi Linton, who I don't think ever scored for us, but he went as well. So not our strongest area of the pitch, but last season, although we were a very good side, we were very much based on a really good goalkeeper and fantastic back four. So they're the ones that are going to keep us really competitive in the league. And of course, we're going to have to find our feet at home. But I just think nine games in, 1-4, lost four, drawn one, pretty much shows that we're an average National League side at the moment, and probably scoring those goals at home will be the difference as to whether we climb the table or fall a little bit. But at the moment, we're in no danger of troubling probably the relegation or the promotion party, to be honest with you. But I just think it's too early to give too many reasons about scoring at home. You can say lack of quality in forward areas, but we're playing in the National League, so it's a relative lack of quality in defence. So I'd like to reserve judgment on that a little bit before I fly in and say we need to do this, this and this, because I've only seen them four times at home.
But away form's been good going to Oldham.
Yeah, I mean, Oldham's going to be the first proper stiff away test that we've had, I think. Like I said, a lot of the teams we've played have been in the bottom half going away from home. Oldham are a proper EFL club, really, aren't they? I think they were in the Premier League at one point, proper stadium. And that'll probably be the first time this season where we look at it and go, okay, you know, maybe we don't go all out on this and play the usual way. Maybe we might go into a little bit more of a solid 4-3-3 away from home and try and nick a point. We haven't really done that in a long time, because last season we were expected to win every game. Like I said, this season our away games have been slightly easier. So it'd be interesting to see how we come out of that one. But Oldham are a club, obviously, at home with a lot of pressure on them as themselves as well. I think they get 5,000 in that Boundary Park every week. So sometimes it's nice to go to a club where all the pressure's on them rather than us. And it feels like it's been sort of that way around for a long time now. So, yeah, I'm not going, but I'll be watching. And hopefully we can go and probably upset the odds. I expect Oldham will be favourites at the weekend, and it will be a great result if we can get something up there.
Yeah, good luck to the Glovers. Right, boys, that's all we've got time for. We'll be back next week. We'll obviously review all of the weekend action, look ahead to more EFL Cup games and the start of the Europa League as well, where Tottenham and United get their campaigns underway. But cheers, boys. Pleasure as always.
Cheers, lads. 1, 2, 3.